This is a Thinking Aloud podcast from the BBC, and for more details on our terms of use and much, much more about Thinking Aloud, go to our website at bbc.co.uk. Hello. Most of us, I'm sure, have experienced those moments when our identity has been read off from our known religious, political, cultural, or even geographical affiliations. I'm not merely talking about those occasions when Scots have to endure references to their stinginess or Liverpudlians have to smile at jokes about thieving Scousers, but those more serious moments when a good argument, a very good argument, is disregarded or dismissed because that's what all you lefties would think, or, oh, that's good coming from a Catholic, or I wouldn't expect anything else from a bleeding Tory. Of course, at such times we'll often fight back against such crude attempts to fit us into the confines of a single identity. I'm not that sort of Tory. I haven't been a proper Catholic for years. But as I realised when I was reading a new research paper on Muslim women and sport, some identity ascriptions are much, much harder to resist. Because while Muslim men are now frequently regarded as dangerous social problems, as angry, as fundamentalist, Muslim women in turn are stereotyped as passive, controlled, oppressed. Well, that research paper is intriguingly called, Proud Brits, Heterosexy Girls and Tomboys, Muslim Women, Basketball and Self-Body Politics. Its author is Samaya Farooq, who's a postdoctoral researcher in sport development and outreach at the University of Gloucestershire. Sam, I mean, these women contradict all these stereotypes in so many ways, but let me first of all just tell me how... Here, you're, it's a study of Muslim women basketball players. Yeah. How did you find these people? How did you come across them?
Well, basically, I was training at the gym one day and I noticed that there was only one other woman that was occupying the space where the free weights were being used. And she came up to me and we started talking and we had a really intriguing conversation. And one of the things that she said to me was, I rarely ever see Muslim women using this gym. And as we started talking, she started kind of breaking every single stereotype about Muslim women. Here she was. She was a qualified PE teacher. She was a professional basketball coach. And she was interested in talking to me. Now, as a researcher that spent almost 9 years of my life researching the issue of Muslim women in sport, I was fascinated that somebody was actually willing to listen to what I have to say about sport and Muslim women.
Why this coach? Why did she set the group up in the first place? Tell me about the origins of the group.
Yeah, I think the community within which she decided to carve out this particular basketball space, it was a community where there were many opportunities for women to engage in sport already. There were many opportunities for men and women to engage in sport. However, she found that either they were largely male-dominated spaces, even if they were for kind of, you know, predominantly women-only sessions, and they were kind of exclusive gender-segregated spaces, men would constantly occupy the territories outside or inside, and they would jeer, you know, they'd jeer women or they'd mock the women and they'd stare at them. And so she wanted to create this more protective space. And also her own experiences, I think, of engaging with sport in the mainstream, kind of that traditional benchmark model of sport, had discriminated against her. You know, she wanted to wear the veil, she wanted to observe her faith, and found that the majority of sporting spaces that she accessed didn't recognise her religious observance as something that needed to be catered for. They weren't appealing for her.
I just wonder what they made of you, because I mean, you're a Muslim, you don't wear a headscarf, and unlike the basketball players, you're a first-generation...
Yeah, I'm a first...
First-generation Pakistani.
Yeah, I'm a first-generation Pakistani Muslim woman.
So what did they make of you?
I think initially, when the coach first told these girls that, you know, this lady will be coming along, she was born in Pakistan in a village in between the mountains, and she came to the UK and had never been to school, spent her life playing cricket in the fields, and you'll be meeting her for the first time. They immediately thought that I'd be like their mothers or I'd be like their grandmothers. And I walked in and they were absolutely shocked that I could speak as they were speaking and that I'd been educated the way they'd been educated. And I had the same sorts of cultural affiliations. And I think the stereotype they really struggled to get over was that I was the daughter of an imam and I wasn't wearing the headscarf and I didn't feel the need to... show my religiosity through a piece of cloth on my head, and I could observe my modesty in lots of different ways.
Now,
and that was really challenging for them.
There are so many interesting things here, but this basket, I mean, playing basketball, I mean, it's a sport with a pretty masculine image. I mean, was it deliberately chosen almost as a way of fighting against prevailing stereotypes of Muslim women?
I think it probably was. I mean, there's something in basketball that makes it always associated with kind of aggressive, boisterous men, tough men. And Dennis Rodman really captures that really well. You know, and a lot of people have talked about the way in which he embodies this complex gender body politics in the way that he occupies a basketball space. But I think the other reason why this particular space was created was because of the basketball coach. She was skilled. She knew how to play basketball, and it was her passion. She dedicated so many years of her life playing it, and found that within that local community, that geographical location, women's basketball was not catered for. Basketball itself was not catered for. And she'd spent about 14 years of her life shooting hoops in the garden, and eventually thought, you know what, I'm sick of this. I want to create my own space.
The material you have on body image is so interesting, because, I mean, some of these people that you were talking to were very body conscious, irrespective of whether they were wearing the full body veil outside the gym. Let's hear from one. This is Tabassum.
Most people think that because I wear this shapeless black thing, there must be a shapeless blob underneath it too. They think I don't worry about how my body looks or worry about my appearance because no one sees what I'm like underneath these clothes. But that's wrong. I'm like any other single woman. I'm into fashion, makeup. I want to feel attractive. I can't stand love handles and all that wobbly jelly in my jeans. I'm like any other woman out there. I just wear this because I feel protected in it, you know.
Now, I should explain that we just sort of voiced up that interview from your paper.
Absolutely.
But, I mean, you describe this woman as, you put her into the category, you have three categories, heterosexy girls.
Yes, absolutely.
Heterosexy girls, describe
them. Yes. I think in my research, what we found is that heterosexy girls were women that kind of occupied basketball or came to basketball because they saw that it provided a specific function for them. And it was about making women feel fit, not necessarily in the sense of the health, in terms of the physiological benefits they could accrue from occupying this territory, but more in the sense that they wanted to be seen as being hot, seen as being heterosexually desirable to men predominantly. And they wanted to be agile, they wanted to be seen as attractive. And I think basketball itself was a way for them to engender all of these aspects, these characteristics.
You talk about the makeup they wore, the manicured nails, the jewelled hijabs.
Yeah, absolutely. So, for instance, on the court, we saw enactments of both a kind of what I like to call a dramatised and a sensationalised hyper-heterosexual femininity. And we also see a more assertive, more aggressive heterosexual femininity that in itself isn't necessarily associated with girly girls, because they're constantly defined as being passive, as being quite docile, as not wanting to sweat. And here you have women that are trying to be both at the same time. And it was really interesting that they would come to this basketball space kind of beautifully decorated in these exquisitely jewelled hijabs, you know, the big hijabs and the perfectly manicured nails, and then have an amazing game of basketball and not be afraid to sweat or anything like that. They were tough players, you know, they were agile, they were aggressive, they were boisterous on
the court. I listened to you, but you've got two other groups. You've got the proud Brits, these are people who wanted to compete internationally, excited by the possibility of playing at Muslim women's games. A third group, I just move on to because time's limiting us, but the exotic tomboys, women like Tasleem.
Most people think that guys hate women who can run faster than them, or diss women who are generally better at sports than them, but I've never experienced that myself. Guys that I know like my power. They say it's sexy. They like that I can give them a run for their money on the court, and why not? I mean, I train harder than they do.
So, exotic tomboys. Tell me a little bit more about them.
I think for these exotic tomboys, basketball was a place, it was a space where these women could perform alternative forms of Asian femininity. So in a way, they were trying to break away from that mould of Asian women always being seen as being passive, being domesticated and being quite docile and not wanting to exert their femininity or their desires or their physicality in any sort of way. And I don't think that for these particular women it was ever about, for instance, undoing conventional scripts of gender or undoing femininity in any way. If anything, it was about ascribing a more aggressive sense of physicality to what it meant to be a woman and not necessarily saying, well, this sense of physicality makes me a boy. I don't want to be a boy. There's nothing wrong with a woman being powerful. I want to be a powerful feminine woman. And that's what the exotic tomboys were doing.
You said originally when you were speaking to me that you wanted to unpack the stereotypes of what a Muslim woman was. You said certainly done that in your research. Yeah. Sumaya Farooq, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Well, he's fitting in quite well, said my friend when I asked her how her 11-year-old boy was getting on at his new school. There are only about 8 other white boys in his form, but because he's a bit brownish himself, he doesn't really seem to notice. Well, as last week's discussion of the late 19th century preoccupation with skin colour made clear, being a bit brownish rarely conferred any sort of advantage. Not as A.E. Hill reminded me that we needed to go that far back to find a time when accurate colour coding was a political priority. Laurie, I spent time in Rheinwesmark on the southern bank of the Orange River in South Africa reporting for BBC Radio in 1995. The people were being allowed to return to their homeland decades after being removed. The land had been used during the apartheid regime by the army for training, and in one abandoned building we found a colour chart. We were told it had been used by the regime when the people were removed to decide where they should be sent. It was a card with squares of colour. Very disturbing. Our discussion, of course, focused primarily on the manner in which the colour yellow had been conferred on the Chinese. Bruce Atter wondered what the fuss was about. I find it amusing, Laurie, that deemed offensive to describe a characteristic Chinese complexion as yellow, when in Africa and among black people in the US and Caribbean, a yellow complexion in a woman generally indicates beauty. Most of your correspondence, though, was prompted by our discussion of the new, more belligerent interviewing techniques. Several listeners, including Carolyn Cummings Osmond and Edward Wheatley, thought that our casual references to the BBC's impartiality were misplaced. Mr. Wheatley said, led by Radio 4 programmes like yours, the BBC is a propaganda machine of the chattering classes and in no way represents the views of the vast majority of licence fee payers. But the email which I found most intriguing came from Roger Whiting. Your item on interviewing techniques has finally explained to me why I find the Today programme so tedious and unsatisfying. The interviewers have obviously noticed the American belligerence and sought to copy it. However, they then remember their duty to be neutral. It becomes incoherent when the interviewer tries to set up a belligerent but neutral approach. The Americans always combine their belligerence with a clearly stated, perhaps misguided, coherent argument which is entirely opposed to that of the interviewee. Thank you all. In case you'd like to comment on anything in today's programme, here are our addresses. Thinking Aloud, BBC Radio 4, Broadcasting House, London W1A, 1AA, or you can email us at thinkingaloud@bbc.co.uk. Of course, if you want to hear the programme again, check out our archive, sign up for my newsletter. This week, I was a teenage theorist. Or download our podcast. All you've got to do, go to the BBC website and click through to Thinking Aloud. Meanwhile, on the steps of the cathedral.
I think it's become evident to a lot of us that we're on a turning point of history. We're on a turning point of mankind and civilization as we know it. And you lot are in the driving seat and we know what we're doing.
A voice from the occupation of St. Paul's, a voice calling for action. But action against what? You don't need to spend long outside the cathedral to realise there's a sizeable hit list. Capitalism, greed, financial chicanery, the growing gap between the rich and the poor, and globalisation.
My name is Celia and I am from Greece. For me, globalisation is a few people with access to wealth can invest to different countries, mostly because they can find cheaper workers. The profit goes back to them.
Globalisation means the destruction of collective cultures, the destruction of collective modes of organisation and production. People are thrown off the land. They lose their ability to produce the wealth they need to live. They lose their ability for subsistence. We see that corporations own huge tracts of Africa and produce for Western markets. Meanwhile, millions of people suffer famine.
I'm from Turkey and I could feel the impact of globalization on myself through my childhood and through my youth as well. There was the rise of the cultural globalization, cultural imperialism, for example. We were under the constant impact of an effect of the Western culture. The new generation was cut off from its own culture.
If you live in a small village in England, people have, you know, there are lots of villagers who've tried to stop, say, Tesco's encroaching in their villages, and say Bristol recently, where there were, you know, riots actually flared up because there's so much opposition. In that example, local values and cultures are being eroded by something very global and homogenous. I mean, I'm someone who's cynical, I suppose, so I think of the bad things first. But, you know, everyone talks about kind of the communication of globalisation through the internet, through mobile telephones. We're able to have live link-ups with Occupy Wall Street, with occupations in Hong Kong who have just emailed us today.
I think here at Occupy London is globalisation. We're here in solidarity with almost 1,000 occupations that are going on globally. We live in a world now where it's not just people who are in the Bilderberg Group or who are in global multinational corporations who can talk to each other and divvy up the world's resources as they see fit, but also the small people, the little man and the little woman, have now got an opportunity to talk to each other in order to fight back.
Voices from St Paul's Cathedral. And we asked those protesters specifically about globalisation because of the interesting, well, the provocative suggestion in a new book that many of us, including commentators and social theorists, have been rather too inclined to concentrate upon the negative connotations of the term, too ready to regard changes in the workings of capitalism as necessarily an erosion of former, more authentic forms of life, too ready in the face of capitalism's persistence to lapse into melancholia and pessimism. Well, that book is called Still Life, Hopes, Desires and Satisfactions, and its author is Henrietta Moore, who's Professor of Social Anthropology at the University of Cambridge. I mean, your book is very much, Henrietta, it's an attempt to make us think differently, to stop ourselves being caught up by received ideas. Let's just talk a little bit about this globalisation and some of the ways in which that word features in discourses today, in dialogues today. You want to suggest, I mean, I've used those words like pessimism and melancholy already, and negative. You want to say there's another way of looking at it?
Well, yes. I mean, I think we tend to concentrate on ideas about impact and loss. The idea that everyone is somehow going to end up eating McDonald's hamburgers and there will be no way forward. And I think there are several problems with that, one of which is that the West is no longer the starting point of forces of globalisation, if it ever was, because, of course, there have been other moments of globalisation historically, perhaps none as intense as the one we're experiencing, but we might think of the Mughal Empire or the Persian Empire or the Roman Empire or many other such moments, including the mercantile 18th century and so on. But I think that the problem at the moment is that we think of the fact that there can be, in our worst nightmare, there is no alternative to capitalism. Capitalism is something that is grinding us down. And yet we heard that young woman at the end of your insert there saying, here we are together, solidarity. I mean, one of the great things about globalisation is that the anti-globalisation movement is a global movement. And that should alert us to the fact that there are many positive things that come out of globalisation, including the way we can think imaginatively about relationships with people we've never actually met.
Let's talk for a second also about that other contention, the way in which modern developments are so frequently spoken of against, almost, if you like, a paradigm of the authentic which existed at some previous time.
Yes.
I mean, you seem to be suggesting this is almost a way of thinking that we need to get out of, and not just a way of thinking among general public, but a way of thinking among social theorists.
Yes, I think it's very prevalent amongst social theorists, probably more prevalent amongst them than the general public, rather worryingly. I think that we're often anxious about change, and I think the reason why we're anxious about change is because humans are very good at understanding that they need to make sense of the world around them. So when things change, they know they're going to have to make new sense, give new interpretation, provide new meanings, and that creates anxiety. But there's never been a moment when cultures have been steady or static or homogenous. In fact, most of the successful cultures of the world have always drawn on other cultures for their vibrancy, for their innovation, for their forward-looking ideas.
I mean, we did hear somebody there talking, using the phrase cultural imperialism. This is the notion that perhaps all high streets are beginning to look the same, that, you know, products and particular things are erasing local cultures. I mean, you know, the indigenous foods are being erased by these McDonald's. I mean, there is some strength in this argument, isn't there, that global capitalism does it does something to take away distinctive local differences.
Well, it does, I think, both take away distinctive local differences and allow for their recreation, because for every moment that we have the high street full of chains, we also have the slow food movement. We have more and more small producers of olive oil in Italy, more and more small producers, we hope, of olives in Greece, and so on. And I think that we're always thinking, can I find now the absolutely wonderful organic butcher who will produce the best salami possible? Or can we find the new English cheese? Or can we find even a decent English wine?
Now, the other element here, because what globalization does point towards the idea of imitation and sameness and reproduction, the notion that everything is getting more like everything else. But you want to talk, I mean, you provide a very interesting example of what you want to talk about as the creativity of culture. And the group that you pick on are some Indonesian fashion designers. Yes. Now, could you just tell me exactly what they're doing and why what they're doing doesn't represent, if you like, an aspect of globalisation insofar as they're picking up bits from other cultures?
Yes, they're working like bricoleurs, as we would say, people bringing together many different kinds of things. So they draw images from Victorian England, they draw images from 1970s rock bands in New York, they draw images from ECAT, from the traditional textiles, and they put all these things together to create a new fashion form. And so what they're doing, in a sense, is drawing on sets of cultural resources that are there, available to them, some of them available through the internet, some of them available through other means, and using new technologies are creating new and innovative materials, outfits, designs, and so on. And so these are people who are making the world anew by using imitation.
And so you really want to resist the word, though, imitation, don't you? Because it's what comes out of this, if you like, I mean, like the uniform of the punk boy or something, by putting all these elements together, which are imitations of other styles, that something new is created.
Yes. I mean, imitation, of course, is never perfect, as we know, mimesis. If you imitate something, it's always slightly different from the original. Indeed, even the best comics, when they imitate someone, we know that they're being comical precisely because they're not actually perfect.
Now, your emphasis upon culture as not, if you like, a static element is very nicely exemplified as well. Another example you give where you might talk about culture being remade. And this is an example I think you use in relation to your own work. You've done a great deal of work over your life in Kenya, but on female circumcision. Tell me about how culture is remade in order to do something about bringing an end to this particular practice.
Well, normally when we think about bringing an end to a practice, we think about a force from outside, perhaps missionaries, perhaps the government or something of this sort. But here we have a group of local women who decided that what they would do to tackle this problem of female circumcision was to develop an alternative female initiation ceremony, and to bring together women to celebrate this life transition that young women are experiencing, you know, about the time that they begin menstruating and so on, to mark that, to mark their movement into the community as adult women, to train them in the way that the old ritual used to in some of the culture and the ideas and the values and so on of the community, but to do it in a way which did not involve circumcision. And they developed then, of course, a series of songs, a series of dances, a series of performances and poetry to go with it. So all the trappings of a new ritual.
So this is, because this word hope features in your book. It's a very odd word. I checked a whole number of other books in social science if I could find any index entry for hope. No. But you want to put hope there because this fits very much with your idea of culture as a, it was like as a progressive idea, as something that people use in order to determine their own future, the way their lives are going to be in the future, rather than something which traps people into identities.
Yes, and I think that's part of the problem. We've been thinking about culture as difference too much. We need to go back to an older idea of culture as an art of living, as a way of establishing relationships with other people, as a way of making sense of the world around us, as a way of enjoying our lives, and focus very much on how particularly young people are very animated by aspiration and by hope. And that's a good thing, because they're also animated by injustice, and they want to overcome that injustice to have a better future, and we should all be behind that.
I wonder how you were reacting to Sam when Sam was talking about these Muslim basketball players, because you there must have thought, this in a way fits rather well into yours, because it's not as though these people are doing this because they are, as it were, cocking a snook or putting their fingers up to a culture. They're doing something because they want to. They're creating something new.
That's absolutely right. And nor are they doing it because they are being affected by Americanization. They're doing it precisely because they want to be themselves. They want to have a new way of engaging with their faith and a new way of engaging with fashion, with desire, with hopefully all these young men that they want to attract.
And one of the other ways in which you say we overlook, if you like, the creative elements or the creative capacity of culture is by the manner in which we denigrate the virtual world, or we denigrate technology, if you like. Whereas we did hear it in a couple of those people, didn't we, from St. Paul's, saying, oh, well, as you said before, it links us around the world. But you'd want to go further than that.
Well, humans have always been involved with technology. It's a way that we extend the reach of the human body. Just we're doing that now as your listeners are listening to us. They can't actually see us speaking, but they can hear us. And there are many ways now we use digital technology to do that, online games, online environments, and so on and so forth. And what's positive about that, I think, is these are new ways of relating. These are new ways of being imaginative, new forms of being humanly cultural, and we should celebrate them.
One example, I remember I went to see the film The Matrix and came out afterwards saying, oh, goodness, I had the faintest idea what was going on. And now I realise from reading your book why I hadn't the faintest idea what was going on. I mean, explain to me how The Matrix represents an instance of a move away from passivity. We're not just simply sitting there watching a picture and going home afterwards. We're being invited to enter into a whole complex set of relationships.
You are, and in a complex set of cultural clues, which are about books, George Orwell, about the Bible, about the Quran. Many, many things are mentioned in The Matrix. And you're being invited as well to decode them with other people who are similarly interested and do that online, in online games, in fact, even by meeting in parks in Tokyo and reenacting scenes from The Matrix.
So it's not... The other thing that... We were talking about identity politics, but we can miss out... If we talk about identity politics, about what it is to be, you know, to be a Muslim woman, or what it is, you know, to be an Afghani man, or whatever it is, that we miss out on elements which don't fit into this classification. There's one that you quote, I'll have to ask you to be brief on this, but you talk about, in Egypt, the urban women's mosque movement.
Yes.
Now, tell me about the paradoxes of this, but why it fits your case that we should really take a fresh look at how culture works.
Well, because these are women who are entering a new relation with their faith. And yet at the same time, as they do that, outsiders, particularly feminists, say, well, this is patriarchy. They are simply, in a sense, being brainwashed without realising that these women are involved in a reformist relation to the faith and indeed to their lives, to reanimating their lives through faith.
Because it is, I mean, because if you were perhaps if you were a traditional theorist of women's rights or whatever, and you looked at this, you might say these people are colluding in their own subjugation. I mean, they're coming out to the mosque,
yes,
and they're learning how, according to the Quran, they should live their lives.
Yes, and that's entirely that's what some commentators have said, but the women themselves have been very, very clear that that's not how they see it.
Final thing. I could even read your book as a self-help book in a way, couldn't I? Because it's almost suggesting, really, that you pick up on Foucault and the idea of culture as something people draw upon in producing versions, new versions of themselves, self-formation. Mm. It's a self-help book in a way?
In a way, because I think we all ought to have the idea that we could be different from the way we are now.
Thank you. Henrietta Moore, thank you very much. Do you know, I think perhaps the idea of a cheerful social scientist is paradoxical, because I can still remember a cartoon in which a male sociologist is handing a female sociologist a bunch of flowers, and she is smiling broadly. The caption underneath reads, "Ah, hegemonies, how lovely." Well, I do hope you enjoyed that programme, and if you'd like to hear something similar, why not try downloading the In Our Time podcast at bbc.co.uk/radio4.